Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gunnar Tinbergen? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, the great Broadway songwriter Stephen Sondheim is my guest. His book, Finishing the Hat, published by Knopf, is the first volume of his collected lyrics. It covers work from 1954 to 1981 and comes with attendant comments, principles, heresies, grudges, whines, and anecdotes. It's one I've been waiting for eagerly. From West Side Story to Merrily We Roll Along, Finishing the Hat is a book that puts on display the enormous amount of work that Stephen Sondheim puts into the writing of a theater song, down to tiny concerns about A's and A's, the's and but's and and's. It's an extraordinary process. I wonder, when you first began to hear lyrics, I know they were often Oscar Hammerstein's, had the difficulty occurred to you?
No, I'd never thought about writing them. And I don't think Hammerstein's were the first I heard. In fact, they weren't. I grew up on... My father had records of people like Fats Waller and Roger and Hart. And so I heard a lot of songs long before I heard any of Hammerstein's, or even knowing, I should say, that I heard of any of Hammerstein's. I probably heard some of the Hammerstein-Kern stuff, Showboat, let's say, without knowing it. But, you know, it didn't particularly interest me. So, no, nothing really occurred to me about the difficulties.
When did they become apparent?
Oh, after I submitted my 15-year-old show, that's say I was 15 years old and submitted a school show that I'd written to Oscar in the surety that he was going to produce it, and asking to treat it as if he didn't know me. By that time, I was sort of a member of his family, sort of an orphan member of his family, and had been since the age of 11. And I said, pretend you don't know me, and it just crossed your desk. And he said, well, in that case, I have to tell you it's the worst thing I ever read. And then he proceeded to tell me why it was the worst thing. But he treated me like an adult, and he did it as an encouragement, because he said, it's not that it's not talented, but let's just take a look at how the songs are structured and how the rhymes are made and how the scenes are constructed and how the characters evolve and the inconsistencies. And he went through it page by page. It was all in one afternoon, so he didn't get very far because there were so many errors on every page. But we got 15, 20 pages into my show, and I learned, as I've said many times, I probably learned more about songwriting for the theater in that afternoon than most writers learn in a lifetime.
It must have been crushing. How quickly were you able to adapt?
Oh, in 5 minutes, because it was so fascinating listening to him talk about it. And he, you know, I knew he loved me, and or at least liked me at the very least. And it was a disappointment, not a hurt.
Did he show you his worksheets? Because one of the fascinating things in Finishing the Hat is the opportunity to see many of them side by side and to see the impulses that run into the making of a song.
No, I never saw any of his worksheets. He didn't really share his work habits with me. He once, when he wrote The King and I remember, he showed me the script. This was before it went into rehearsal. I'd had a bad time with my mother, who was a difficult woman, and he asked me to come over to his house, and I think in order to calm me down, he gave me a script of The King and I, and said, why don't you set some of these lyrics to music, and then see what Dick Rogers does with them, and we'll,
wow.
So it was a way of diverting me, and it did, but otherwise I never saw any of his work in progress, no.
That's extraordinary. Did you set them?
I set We Kiss in the Shadow, and I set it as a waltz because it seems to me so clear when you read the lyric that it's in three. And, of course, Dick Rogers set it in four, which taught me a lot about how different composers think about different things. His is a much more original setting than mine was.
When you got the opportunity to work with Rogers, one of the sadder descriptions in Finishing the Hat, by that time, What did you think it would be like to have that opportunity?
I didn't think one way or another. It was something that Arthur Lawrence sort of talked me into, and Oscar had, when he was dying and knew he was dying, he said to me, you know, when I'm gone, Dick is going to feel very bereft, and though I know you want to write your own music, I wish you would consider writing something with him. And I said, of course I will. And over a period of a couple of years after Oscar did die, Dick kept sending me projects, or not kept sending me, sent me two, I think, and they didn't appeal to me. But because I'd had such a good time working with Arthur Lawrence, when the opportunity came, it was actually Arthur's idea to adapt one of Arthur's plays called The Time of the Cuckoo into a musical, it seemed like a good way of killing two birds with one stone, and it was not.
And in finishing The Hat, you demonstrate how sometimes the very best lyrics won't do. You talk about one of your own favorites, Pretty Little Picture, as one that holds up the show. Is that what a lyricist has to expect in the process of working a show into place?
What, you mean the business of cutting out songs? Or
cutting out songs, you know, finding that your favorites are somehow not going to make it.
Yeah, well, Pretty Little Picture actually the reason, there was more than one reason for Pretty Little Picture being cut. First of all, Forum has numbers that hold up the action. That's part of what happens in the first act. Forum is not a show in which the songs carry the story forward for the most part. And they are what Bert Shevelov, who co-wrote it with Larry Gelbart, described as respites in the action. He said, you know, this is different than the kinds of shows that Oscar writes and that you've been trained to write, he said, and what he meant was really that it was more like the shows pre-Oscar, pre-Oklahoma, the Rodgers and Hart shows and the Cole Porter shows, where songs were merely raisins in the cake. You know, it was a comedy scene and then a song and a comedy scene and then a song, and the songs were not meant to carry the story forward. That was I won't say an invention of Oscar's, but that's what he developed in the musical theater. So, Pretty Little Picture, the first act wasn't working anyway. The whole show wasn't working out of town. And but more important, Zero was not a patter singer. You know, he had his speech patterns and his, in fact, all of his comedy had to do with bluster and not with patter. And this, and the role was designed when I wrote the song. The role was designed for a kind of terrier-like comic, not Zero. Zero was supposed to play the pimp, and Milton Berle was supposed to play. Actually, we wrote it for Phil Silvers. And Phil Silvers, when Larry and Bert brought him the script, he said, gosh, this is just like all the shtick I've been doing all my life, meaning Sergeant Bilko, which, of course, Sergeant Bilko is a form of pseudolus. So Plautus invented that character and invented the sitcom, as a matter of fact. When you trace sitcoms back to where they really come from, they come from Plautus's plays. Phil Silvers, I sort of designed it with that kind of fast-talking Sergeant Bilko mouth in mind. And then when he reneged, we got Milton Berle. And Milton Berle had a similar kind of thing. He could have done it, I think. But Zero was supposed to play the pimp, was supposed to be Lycus. And the irony was, of course, that he ended up playing Pseudolus. The double irony was, in the movie, he ended up playing Pseudolus, and Phil Silvers ended up playing the pimp.
So there, essentially, you are at that stage of your career. A show not produced, West Side Story, but not with your music, Gypsy, with Julie Stein's music, and a funny thing. Anyone can whistle, then do I hear a waltz, then 6 years before the next show, which I think of as the time that you spent interrogating individual words in order to make crossword puzzles.
You're talking about the period between Do I Hear a Waltz and Company?
Yeah.
Well, that was, first of all, it was only 5 years. It was 65 to 70. And secondly, I wrote, James Goldman and I wrote the first few drafts of The Girls Upstairs, which turned into Follies during those years. Then Company came along, and because George Firth's plays came along, and Hal said, I'd love to do this as a musical. And I said, well, as soon as I finish Follies, maybe we can talk about it. He said, no, I want to do it first. And I'll tell you what, if you write company and do it first, I'll do Follies second. I said, okay, fine. So, no, those were not as fallow years as you think.
Oh, so you were doing those while you were also, because I think of those puzzles as being like a full-time job.
No. They were, well, it was, no. I was fairly quick and glib about those puzzles. That was in 1969. That was the year just before Company, and it was, I guess I was writing Company at the same time, and I quit the puzzles. I did quit the puzzles after a year because I thought I got to get the show for it. It wasn't a full-time job. It was, I would say it was probably a day a week.
For listeners who are just coming in, I'm talking to Stephen Sondheim, and I'm talking about a little-known period of his life, but very well-known to me, because every week in the New York magazine, Sondheim was doing really an American version of the British cryptic crosswords, and these were so brilliantly done and opened my eyes, really, to looking at single words and how they were composed and how they could surprise and trick you. And then comes Company, a very original show where you begin to move beyond the Rodgers and Hammerstein show.
Oh, indeed.
Into a form that is, in a way, based on review.
Yes, it's a hybrid. It's a hybrid between review and book. And as such, was a real, in its own way, an invention. But it, one of the things one of my principles, as I say in the book Finishing the Hat, is that content dictates form. And here the content was a cursory examination of five marriages and a single man who is contemplating marriage and observing the five married couples who are his closest friends. And how would you structure such a thing once you decide to do that? Well, you're not going to try to, or you'd be foolish to try to weave the five into some kind of plot line story. And therefore, what is suggested is individual scenes. But at the same time, you don't want to do just five little one-act musicals. And therefore, it turned out to be exactly what it turned out to be, which is a combination of review and what used to be called a book.
You did, I think, three musicals with George Firth, who here in L.A. was beloved by many of us. If I'm not mistaken, Company were George's first plays, the plays.
Yes, he was. Apparently he was in analysis, and the analyst suggested that he might write down some of the things he was feeling and some of the things he was observing in the form of, I think he just said write. I don't think he said play or short story, but write. And so George, indeed, sat down and wrote, I think, 11, it may have been 7, little one-act plays that were his observations on emotional commitments.
And then he's learning to put together a show with you and Harold Prince.
Yeah, well, the three of us talked at length, because the plays came to Hal's attention because they were going to have a Broadway production and it had fallen through and George didn't know what to do. And he called me and he said, I don't know what to do now, that my production has fallen through. And I said, well, let me give them to Hal Prince, who's very savvy. And Hal at that point was a producer who had just begun directing. And I said he would really know what to do. Hal said he thought it could be a musical, which surprised both George and me. And he flew George in from the coast, and we just sat and talked about it a bit. And then George and I went home and gave it a big think and thought, you know, what could hold the play together was the fact that almost all of his little one acts had a catalyst third character in them. They were about a couple plus a third character. And the third character was different, of course, in each play. And not all the couples were married. Some of them were just living together or flirting. But whatever it was, there was a third character. We thought the third character, because we had to have something to hold the evening together. And once we got the idea of Bobby as an observer of these marriages and somebody who was looking to make an emotional commitment or not, then the whole thing fell into place quite quickly.
That's so interesting because it's in the show Company where some of the songs are from the position of observers, too.
They're all observational songs, really. None of them, unless they constitute a scene, like they do in Barcelona, where the whole scene is a song.
Finishing the Hat by my guest Stephen Sondheim is published by Knopf. It's a collection of the lyrics from the first half, approximately, of his career up to the point that he met James Lapine. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm. We'll return after this break. I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Stephen Sondheim about Finishing the Hat, which is his collected lyrics from 1954 to 1981. Now, those commentary songs become very much more complicated in the next show, Follies, when you are writing show songs that reveal moments in a major character's past which we haven't seen. It's being reenacted as a Follies. And we're in a kind of nightmare breakdown sequence, all of which is structured around a kind of, well, many of them are charm songs or novelty songs. There's even two counterpoint songs, four characters. I was there on the opening night of Follies, and I just about fell out of my seat with astonishment and admiration. But that kind of song, which is both a conventional song, a genre song, and a character song, how did that kind of song evolve?
Well, it's nice of you to say that. I'm not sure that's a character song. It is a genre song that deals with the situation in which the four characters are finding themselves. So I had the notion of utilizing folly songs to reflect the states of mind of the four principals in a surreal setting, a surreal Follies.
You've admired the lyrics of DeBose Hayward for their simplicity, and I wonder, when the lyrics become complicated, do you consequently, your own lyrics, distrust them?
I'm not sure what you mean.
Well, when I got the recording of the complete Follies, so-called, on two discs, and I heard for the first time a song, I guess, that was written for the London Follies, and there's a lyric, I think I'll have it right, as changeable as a chameleon with all that entails, but nobody knew what was really underneath all those veils. And that's the kind of thing you talk about, where writing a lyric is like dealing with flaming torches, juggling with them, torches and knives at the same time. And the lyric is so good that I wonder how you can distrust complexity and ingenuity in a lyric, or prefer the simple?
Well, it depends. First of all, that is a pastiche number. That is like these Follies numbers in the original. That number is a substitution for the number called The Story of Lucy and Jesse, and was written for Diana Rigg because she was not a dancer, and so I decided the only way to solve that was to write it for a singer. But it's the same thing. It's not the complexity is a reflection of the complexity and the wordplay and the playfulness of the lyric writing of that generation, of the Cole Porter generation, of the Yip Harburg generation, of the people who where the songs did not have to do anything but be sources of enjoyment for the audience, and they didn't have to carry any kind of emotional weight at all, and or certainly no story weight. And so you could afford to just play around with words, which I do in the first follies too. You know, the verses of you're gonna love tomorrow, are playful puns and intricate inner rhymes and playing around with words.
Sally dear, now that we're man and wife, I will do wonders to make your life soul stirring and free from care. If we fight, and we might, I'll concede. Furthermore, dear, should your ego need bolstering, I'll do my share. Yes, those verses.
That's exactly the same kind of thing. It's exactly the same thing. The complexity is one of the things I liked about writing those past G songs was it allowed me to play with words and not be untrue to what the characters.
By the final shows in this book, which is just the first volume, and really so much happens afterwards, we've got Sweeney Todd, we've got Merrily We Roll Along, we've got Pacific Overtures, but it seems as if the subsequent musicals go so deep inside the form of what musical comedy can be. Does that become your goal?
Oh, no, I never had a goal. Each story, you know, generates its own style and all that. And, I like stories, obviously, that offer chances to use music in unusual ways, or to use songs, I should say, in unusual ways. But no, I mean, it's nice that you think it gets deeper. Maybe that's just me getting better as a writer.
No, but I'm thinking of, say, Pacific Overtures. Mm-hmm. Now, I may be quite wrong here, but one day I was sitting looking at it, and it seemed that the score was a big spiral, that the songs in the first part are repeated in a different form in the second part, and the complexity was so exciting to me. And if that's not getting deeper as you go along, I don't know what is.
Well, okay, that's nice, and I take it as a compliment. But in fact, the only conscious effort to do that in Pacific Overtures is the opening number and the closing number, which echo each other. And that's because I wanted to show what had happened in 100 years, 120 years. But no, otherwise, the music does get more Western as it goes along, as the country becomes more Westernized. But no, it wasn't. I didn't conceive of it in any way as a score with a shape. I wish I could say I did, but I didn't.
Wow, because I saw.
But you know, the unconscious does that. You know, if you're right. And I don't know that you're right, and I don't know that you're wrong. But if you're right, then it's an unconscious thing. But I believe in that. I think the unconscious can very well shape something that you didn't know, that you're not thinking of on the surface.
It's very interesting that you say that, because, you know, when I went through it, and I think of you as someone not exactly what people say about you, cerebral, but that it's a process of bringing to consciousness.
Oh, it is indeed, but the unconscious is always there, ready to spring forward when you least expect it, and you don't always recognize it. Nobody recognizes it all the time.
The last show in this book is Merrily Roll Along, which is a place, it seems as if in the career of musical comedy writers, things falling apart is almost part of the story. And Merrily We Roll Along is not only about how things fall apart for the characters within the play. It will be the last time you work, well, it won't be the last time you work with Harold Prince. He comes in at a certain point to work on Roadshow, called Bounce then. But it's an end. It's a place where things are going to break up afterwards. I think we're going to, in the next volume, be looking at a new kind of show.
Oh, absolutely.
A kind of show that's made in part out of collage with variable pieces. It's Sunday in the Park with George. Mm. Do you feel that there's an arc that ends with Merrily It Rolls Along?
Yeah, well, there's an arc that ends because I met somebody new. I remarried, and meeting Lapine changed my life professionally, in a very profound way, and changed the way I looked at the theater in a certain way. Although I'd always been of an experimental nature, and Lapine was, but so was Hal, and so there are similarities. But it was, as I will cover in the second book, after all, the first show that James and I did together was off-Broadway. I'd never done an off-Broadway show before. And that is a whole different set of principles and pressures or lacks of pressure, and related so much more to the kind of thing that that Mickey and Judy did in the barn.
Well, it's interesting, because do you think, for instance, If Anyone Can Whistle had been an off-Broadway show, its future would have been different?
It might have been. I think at that point, off-Broadway wasn't quite as developed as that yet, but it might have been. That was the year of experiment. That was the decade of experimentation in plays, and many of them came from off-Broadway. You know, John Guare and Lanford Wilson, Albert Inarritu, that whole group of playwrights who were experimenting with the form, and most of those forms were not being experimented with on Broadway. These were off-Broadway playwrights, and Lapine was an off-Broadway playwright,
yeah,
and
yeah.
So I became an off-Broadway playwright, and the freedom to experiment. Suddenly, part with George is something no Broadway producer would ever have dreamed of producing. The thing is that, you know, when I said no producer would have produced Sonny and Park with George, there is one producer who would have, and that's Hal Prince. Hal Prince was the only producer who was constantly putting his own money, so to speak, and I don't mean out of his own pocket, I mean his own producing money, into experimental pieces. No other producer would ever produce Pacific Overtures, and no other producer would ever have produced... I don't think maybe even Merrily We Roll Along, but you know, Follies. I don't think any other producer would have done that. An elaborate fantasy. I want to add that because Hal, in a way, has the mentality of an off-Broadway playwright, but he just was born on Broadway the way I was.
I've been speaking to Stephen Sondheim. His Finishing the Hat is a combination of collected lyrics, attendant comments, principles, heresies, grudges, wines, and anecdotes. We haven't even begun to speak of the heresies, but we'll do that when the second volume comes out. It's been a great pleasure to be able to talk to you. Thank you for spending time with me.
Thank you, Michael, very much. I've enjoyed it.
I've been talking with Stephen Sondheim, author of Finishing the Hat, published by Knopf. You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from Finishing the Hat at kcrw.com/bookworm. You can podcast this program, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with a click of a button on our media player at kcrw.com. My co-producer is Melinda Siegel. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she's a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
Read this, read that, read this, bookworm. Read this, read that, read this. I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she's a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.